call the Conference Committee on House File 2323 to order. Members and all of you in the audience, we hope you had some time to relax yesterday and had a good day honoring mothers. I called my mother and she called me first actually to say thank you for the flowers. So, and I talked to my, understand my sons didn't catch many walleyes on Vermilion either. It snowed both Saturday morning and Sunday morning. So,
cool.
Saved a lot of walleyes for me actually. They didn't get an opportunity to catch them this weekend. Madam Chair, I had a discussion with the Commissioner this morning about the Truth in Taxation, the repeal of the Truth in Taxation special meeting requirement. And I don't want to speak for the Commissioner, but I believe he said that the Governor was okay with getting rid of a special meeting, but he would like to make sure that the meeting that happens to discuss the budget that the taxpayers receive the notice on, where they have an opportunity to come and testify, that meeting happened in the evening. I think that's all of our intent, is that the public have ample opportunity to participate. So, Madam Chair, how would you feel if we had council work on some language to require that budget meeting that the public is notified about, that it be held in the evening? Not a special meeting, but that the meeting that has that order of business be held in the evening. So can we work on that? Because we had already adopted some language. So if we could have some language to modify that slightly, requiring that budget meeting be held in the evening. Maybe, Commissioner, after 5 p.m. or do we have to put a time? Commissioner, what do you think?
Chairman, boy, I guess I would trust staff some take on that. I'm looking at Ms. Dalton over there. She's the wheels are turning. I guess you want an evening meeting. The governor's concern is that sometimes these meetings are in the afternoon where the average citizen can't show up. He'd like to have a designated meeting in the evening, mm-hmm. After 6 o'clock, after 5 o'clock, to make sure citizens have access to that budgetary discussion.
Ms. Baker?
Yeah.
Okay.
So
it should be not before six. Not before six. We really don't do it over dinner.
Let's say not before six. Madam Chair, not before six?
Not before six.
Okay, let's work on some language relative to that we can adopt here a little bit later.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Marquardt.
Very quickly, last year when we dealt with assessing, we required the county to have a Board of Equalization meeting sometime in the evening, so we could even look at that language. That was the first. And also the tie-in might be maybe that evening one for TNT could be when they do their proposed levy in September, even have that one where they have to do that proposed levy that they can never go higher than. It might be, you could maybe work it that same night. It might be a good night to have it on.
Okay, we'll have staff draft up an amendment to the previously adopted language. Madam Chair, I was curious, I guess one of the last things I tried to do on Saturday and was unsuccessful at that point was a provision for Senator Vickerman it says a county that borders two states. So it only applies to one county in the state, and it would be Rock County, to allow them to continue to impose the aggregate tax before the increase last year. So the previous number. So I think you had said that Representative Magnus had a bill that that Representative Leader didn't like, so I went and looked at the Magnus bill, and the Magnus bill actually repealed last year's increase. I understand why Representative Leader would have pushed back on that. I don't know if there was a Senate companion to that or not, but this is much narrower because it's just for one county. So I'm wondering how the House feels about that today.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Lencheski.
Is it sunsetted then?
And Representative Leader, Ms. Senn contacted him, and I guess, you know, he's okay with it. He's not thrilled about it, but, I mean, are they going to go back up then, like everyone else?
Ms. Baker? We're not on the Magnus bill now. We're on. We're not. Not at all.
Oh, okay.
This is the, Mr. Chair.
Representative Chester.
This is the Vickerman Amendment on Rock County. I don't know if staff has it.
Yeah.
It's the A-47 amendment.
I'm just trying to ascertain if we were to do this, then at a later time, does it go back up to everybody else's, or is it a permanent reduction?
This looks to be permanent, but Madam Chair, if you want to put, you know, a five-year sunset on it, I guess we can always come back and revisit it.
Let's do that. Then just move it.
Senator Skoy moves the A-47 and with a five-year sunset. And then we'll see how it works down there, and that will, I guess, give Representative Magnus or Senator Vickerman, if he's still here, an opportunity to come back and work on this again. And I'm sure maybe some lobbyists can make $20 getting this done for Rock County.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Markquardt,
we could amend this to just allow counties that have a sounding name that deals with aggregates, like Rock County. Because I was wondering if Clay County, but Clay isn't really, you know,
aggregate.
It could, yeah. So, but we could just counties that sound like aggregate.
I've got something better yet. Somebody told me. Maybe somebody can check this out. Somebody told me. Why do we remember some trivia, right? Somebody told me that Rock County is the only county in the state that does not have a lake in it.
That's true.
Naturally.
Senator Vickerman has told us that a few times.
So maybe we could use that for a definition, a county that does not have a natural lake in it.
And the last thing I'll leave you with, if we happen to come back later, is assignment, name the six counties in Minnesota named after presidents. There's six of them. Yeah. So that's for everyone later on today.
So, Marker, what do you teach up in Bill?
Minnesota history and...
Chair, we need that Historical Society database we were talking about the other day.
Okay, on the Skoy Amendment to adopt the A-47 with a five-year sunset. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. Truth in Taxation, we are... working on...
I've got three of them. I got to think of them again. I know there's six, but I...
Lincoln, Jackson, Washington.
Madam Chair, do you want to talk about use deeds?
What are the other three?
Never.
We had talked about... Is Mr. Nord here? I mean, if...
Senator Bach?
We think we got some language worked out, but...
I think this was the item that we were trying to let folks know that unless Representative Mullery is okay, we were not interested in pursuing anything this year.
What did we find out?
And folks were going to, my understanding is everybody was going to meet with Representative Mullery. If they haven't done that, then probably not ready for that.
Madam Chair, how about the Senate's idea of township incorporations into cities? Senator Skoy has been working on some language on that. With the Senate bill has a five-year prohibition on new incorporations.
We oppose that.
Well, Senator Skoy.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lencheski and Representative Markquardt. We do have some language that we've been working on, and I haven't had a chance to run this by Mr. Solem yet, but it would take the moratorium off, but it would ask the department to do a study of the fiscal implications for the state prior to the incorporation taking place. And one of the concerns that we have is that these incorporations from townships into city, then, you know, they become eligible for economic development initiatives like TIF. They come to the legislature for LGA changes, et cetera. And we would kind of like to know what impacts, financial impacts, these incorporations are going to have prior to them taking place. And would the House be willing to consider something like that? And I've got the language drafted. If you'd like, we can pass it out.
Here we go.
Senator Bach, Senator Skoy, we're not, I don't think the House is wanting to work on that. I can't speak for Representative Coonan, who had to go vote in stake of finance. He's coming back. But I, you know, I know he was very opposed to the original provision. Representative Marquardt, I don't know.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I know this is an area of contention, but I would not want to do it now. I mean, there's just a lot, you know, it opens this whole thing up, and this, even what you're suggesting, is something new. And I just, we'd have to hear from the townships and the cities, and I do think we've got to get off step one, but and I'm willing to somehow indicate that as we move into the interim, but I'm not willing to do that now.
Well, Mr. Chair, if Representative Lencheski and Representative Marquardt, the House conferees, would be willing,
okay.
Let me keep working with the interested folks in the department on this and see if we can. You know, we've still got another week left, so we'll keep working and see if we can get you guys to come around on that.
Madam Chair, we had a couple of provisions in the public finance article that we didn't finish up relative to HRAs. And I don't think we probably had enough information. I believe the Senate had the provisions and the House didn't. Can somebody tell me where they are on the side-by-side? Let's either make a decision if we're going to do them or not. I think we kind of put them on hold. Ms. Haney here.
That's for you.
Let's just decide if we're going to do them or not, I guess. I put hold on them.
Look at the bottom note, too, after my notes. So we may not be able to. If we have to do health, but I have to do two. So we're going to have to communicate when we can be in this room. They're going to have me put. Do.
So why do you know the exact language? We're going to just do a delete all. Connie's not here. I talked to her a little bit this morning, but maybe we'll hold on that until somebody sees her come in the room, let me know. Compact Development TIF District, Madam Chair, what do you think? Warming up to that idea?
Just being honest.
To put people to work.
I don't think it works.
We don't know.
We've got way too much TIF. Trying to shrink it, not grow it.
I'm trying to build stuff vertically rather than sprawl it out into all the cornfields.
They're all property tax increases. That's the same with the transit TIF, this one. They're all property tax. So is the HRA thing on the public finance bill. So they're exempting more people from paying property tax.
Double transit?
Oh, Mr. Chair. Spend, you know, if we can spend a little time, I think I could probably talk Representative Lencheski into this. And, you know, transit, you know, is not just about transit. It's about development, redevelopment opportunities and shaping and guiding that growth in a way that creates more opportunities. You know, we had the discussion the other day. Hiawatha is nice, but, you know, there's not the kind of transit-oriented development springing up around those stations that there could be. There's not the tools to guide and shape, develop that growth. So I think it creates more opportunity and more economic vitality than just magically throwing down a track does. You know, and there's research specific to the Twin Cities. There's research that applies across the entire country. If you don't put these finance tools in place, you're just not going to get what, you know, the maximum you can out of transit. It's just not going to happen. I think it's an important initiative.
Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, what do you think?
Well, most states that have transit don't have transit TIF. So, but I guess what I'd say is while there's value to have these transit-oriented communities, I just don't think it's the job of all the other property taxpayers to pay for them. So the effect of putting the transit TIF in place means that, let's say it's in your community's residential property taxpayers and other commercial property taxpayers and your counties all subsidize it. And I mean, if that's something the state values, maybe it should just give them an appropriation, but it's just a subsidy from those who just happen to live in the county or the city where the line's going through, and it's increased property taxes for everyone else. So while that might be a valuable goal, I just don't think it's the job of the other taxpayers to have to pay higher property taxes to subsidize it.
Well, I think if you take a greater measure of the economic activity that you're creating and you're saving on, you know, the kind of development that otherwise would occur, you're taking advantage of existing infrastructure. A lot of it is existing infrastructure that's in place when you're building transit-oriented development, existing sewer, water, roadway systems, sidewalks, lots of stuff. In many cases, existing structures, you're creating no need for building all kinds of parking in a fully built environment. You net out saving, on a metro-wide basis, billions of dollars over the lifetime of building out a transit system for building the kind of development. You know, we have a million people coming to the metropolitan area in the next 15, 20 years. We're not figuring out a way to develop that puts these folks in more proximity to their housing and their jobs and their other services. You're just building infrastructure out beyond the horizon into the green fields. It's going to be extremely expensive if you're not guiding transit-oriented development. This is a tool to do that. That's subsidy. That's serious subsidy.
Well,
Representative Chesky.
Mr. Chair, I guess, you know, one way I think about this is the transit TIF concept, you know, as it would be applied today, because there isn't rail all over the place, would not, you know, if those benefits all accrue to who, I guess, is the question. So in this transit TIF concept, the only people who would pay for that, who would pay the subsidy, are the residents of St. Paul. I mean, that's property and tax increases to the residents of St. Paul and the residents of Ramsey. And as the line comes into Minneapolis, it's only the city of Minneapolis and the residents of Hennepin. So we're going to have the people who live in two cities pay for the benefits that everybody else gets. I mean, to me, it just seems that since a lot of people will get on that line who don't live in Minneapolis and St. Paul, this concept ensures they never have to pay for it. And even if you think they should be subsidized, it seems to me, why should all the people getting on the line who live in the suburbs and driving in and parking not pay for it?
Well, Madam Chair, do you think this development is going to happen otherwise, just by itself?
Central Corridor? Yes. Not by itself, but yeah.
The kind of development that we're envisioning, that we're talking about? I disagree. I don't think it's going to happen unless you build out the kind of infrastructure, build the with the zoning guidelines and the kind of walkable communities and building out, you know, transit-oriented development. I mean, we can. Oh, too bad we don't have a little more time. We can, you know, do the little slideshows and show you, you know, what exactly. I just don't think it's going to happen by itself without some serious land use planning guidance and then the finance tools to put the infrastructure in the ground and in place.
Mr. Chair.
So I don't necessarily agree with your subsidy argument, because I just, you know, I don't think that kind of development is going to happen in the way that we're talking about.
Okay.
Sure, you know, things will be built. Job centers will be built, housing will be built, services and amenities, retail, et cetera, will be built, but it won't be built around these transit stations like this. It'll be built, you know, scattered to the four winds, and we're going to have to build sewer lines and parking lots and roadway systems and you name it to support all of that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Chesky. I guess, and I apologize, Senator Dibble, I thought you meant, did I think the line would be built? Yes, I think the line's going to be built with huge subsidy. And, in fact, after last year's conference committee, when we had money on the bottom line, the half I used was to transit. Every dollar that the House used that was discretionary, I put into transit through sales tax exemptions and other mechanisms for transit. So I'm a big supporter of transit. But do I think the developments around them are going to happen? I don't know, but I don't know whose responsibility that is. I mean, all cities have the use of TIF right now. So all cities do developments. and I don't know that we need another development. We have brownfield TIF tools in current law. So, you know, the argument for me always with transit when people were arguing for it was it'll give you an edge in development. It creates economic development. You want transit because you'll get development. But now the converse argument is being used that, no, you need a subsidy to get the development. And before it was you needed the line to get the development. Now, oh, we have the line, but you need a subsidy too. So, I mean, it seems to me you can't make both arguments simultaneously, and I'm not saying that Senator Dibble is, but for all the transit advocates for years, you know, part of their whole argument is why we needed Hiawatha and Central Corridors. All this development's going to spring up. And now the argument is, but now we need more subsidy. So, I mean, it as a transit advocate myself, it helps the opponents of transit argue further that, see, it's a big waste of money because we have to keep subsidizing everything. So, I mean, I believe that the transit stuff, having transit in your community is already a net benefit for redevelopment that other cities don't have. And to have the property taxpayer subsidize it further, to me, just seems like it's really asking too much for the people who live in those communities and everybody else benefits.
Well, I just don't, Madam Chair, I don't see the two as mutually exclusive. And I don't think anyone has ever made the argument just simply put the transit investment in and nothing else. It clearly has to be packaged together with, you know, making sure that we're getting the transportation facility in there with the land use development regs, with some of the financing tools that help guide, shape, and make sure that the maximum benefit of that, that investment that's in place is maximized to the extent possible for that community. And I don't know if anyone working in the urban planning and transportation arena has ever said, you know, simply slapping down a road, simply slapping down a train means you're done with your work. That's when the work starts.
Sir
Moi.
To maximize that investment.
You know, Ms. Chair and Madam Chair, I was thinking about this. I agree with you to the extent that it will be a burden on St. Paul and Ramsey County taxpayers and Minneapolis and Hennepin County taxpayers. And I think that it is a struggle to try to find the balance on how to get that done. I have been carrying the Central Corridor bill for as long as I've been here, up until the last couple of years when I felt that it was really important to broaden the number of stakeholders who are involved in it. And I've always thought that part of the struggle, I think, with transit has always been that we have this goofy federal formula. It's a goofy federal formula that kind of puts you in a really tight spot. And it's federal money, federal mandate, federal formula to get this construction going, leaving very little space at the county or at the local level to find a way to address some of the needs of the local communities. And it's almost like, my constituents in St. Paul, particularly those who either live or have businesses up along the corridor, have to make a decision to say, we'll sacrifice what we have or what we would like to see happen at the local level, so long as we get what the feds are imposing on us in terms of this very tight formula that they have for distribution of this money. And so I think that you're absolutely right, that we find ourselves kind of in a contradiction. That on the one hand, we very much would like for this to happen because we know that in the big picture, it will stimulate economic development. I think in the big picture, it will stimulate. And for sure, it will stimulate economic development. And yet, you know, our local communities, the people who are most directly affected by it, I think can't sustain themselves until the big picture economic development takes place. And so Senator Dibble is right when he says that, you know, the two aren't necessarily counterproductive. In St. Paul, we've had neighbors who live in the neighborhood where Central Corridor is going to be going through have had a very, very long process. To say, you know, I think that a lot of people around here will remember when I-94 went through that neighborhood, we saw the consequences of what happened. It literally ripped apart one community by putting the the highway right down the middle of the one community. And the neighborhoods, the people who live in the neighborhood still remember to this day. And one of the things that they talked about was that if Central Corridor was going to come through, what is it that we can do to make sure that we, the lesson we've learned doesn't happen again? And they felt that one way to do that is to really work with the city to make sure that whatever happens actually does give some benefits to not only the small businesses, but the neighbors who live in that area. Now, you know, I think we've had the conversation where we've talked about the fact that development will follow, and if development does follow, there might not be much that we can do to protect the residents or the people who live there because property taxes will go up, and at some point the price will be too good and people will have to sell out. But that doesn't mean that we can't do all that we need to at the local level to make sure that we give these people half of a chance to continue to live and benefit from the sacrifices that they've made. And so I agree with you. I mean, it feels like it's in contradiction, and I have mixed feelings about that too, Madam Chair. But I just think that as the different creative ideas are being put on the table, that this, the transit TIF, the Central Corridor TIF, the compact development TIF, these are some tools that we could, doesn't mean that the local governments have to use them, but these are some tools that we can put in place. And if other alternative things happen, if the funding formula at the federal level changes that can accommodate, you know, the remediation issues or the parking issues or the construction of these stations or the development around these stations, if it could be accommodated, if these developments could be accommodated within the federal formula to fund these transit corridors, I don't think that it would be the preference of the local communities or the cities or the counties to come to the state to put added burden on their citizens. But because of the very tight formula at the federal level, we've had to be creative at the local level to make sure that once these transit lines are put in, that our local communities aren't left behind. And I think that, I mean, that's just, for me, with my mixed feelings on how I want to go with this, that's sort of where I have, you know, landed in my balancing of this. So, I mean, I know that it is, we've had a lot of conversations, but I sure hope that the House members will be willing to help us with these TIF districts.
Madam Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Oh, thanks, Mr. Chair, excuse me. I forget that we're have to get to this side. Also, you know, I probably haven't done a super good job of explaining the proposal adequately. I think there's a perception that somehow we're creating a new kind of TIF, transit TIF. And that's not what the proposal is. The proposal establishes the idea of transit improvement areas by cities through their comprehensive plan, you know, in an area circumference around a transit station. And that can be established for any number of reasons, you know, to make sure that the zoning, the underlying zoning with its, you know, development guidelines are in place, you know, compact, mixed use, et cetera, you know, walkable pedestrian areas and the like. That's not the TIF. You know, that's just an area recognized around the station in which transit-oriented development is hoped for in the future, which supports transit, and conversely transit supports that kind of development, denser, you know, with a wider array of living and working and you know other kinds of opportunities. If a TIF district intersects with that transit improvement area as a subset of that transit improvement area, what my proposal would do, you know, combined with Senator Moore's proposal, I kind of try to combine our concepts here into one, is allow some of the increment in that TIF, which would be any normal kind of a TIF that we already have in state statute, you know, redevelopment or all the others, can use some of that increment in that wider transit improvement area for the, you know, the public infrastructure purposes or some of the redevelopment needs that might be needed in that slightly, in that somewhat wider area. So whether that's the kind of a public realm amenities that support a transit-oriented development type of district or, you know, some of the different kinds of building forms and types that are needed in that area. So I'm not creating a whole new type of TIF. I mean, that, I think there's a misperception there. It's allowing some use of the increment in a wider geographic area than just the district itself.
Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so to be clear, are you referencing page 134 of the Senate bill? And I'm also, I think Senator Moi is talking about page 142 of the Senate bill. I think Senator Dibble is talking about page 134. I'm just trying to understand the language on page 134, line 134.9.
Yeah, yes, Madam Chair. Yeah, the section that I'm talking about is section 10, but the language that's changed is 134, and we have an amendment, you know, that so we get rid of the, you know, how the transit improvement area is established. Going to deed to certify the transit improvement area, we just have the municipalities themselves in their comprehensive plan identify and establish a transit improvement area.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lencheski.
I just want to honestly say I'm not persuaded, but I want to understand more. So on Senator Dibble's item, not the Senator Moi's bill on page 142, or I'm not sure who the author was in the Senate, but that's specific to the city of St. Paul.
Yep.
Senator Dibble's is not and would have statewide applicability.
Mm-hmm.
So can you help me walk through how that would work in my city since we have transit?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just a massive giveaway. That's just that my taxpayers are going to have to pay for. And I would guess that, there's a new station being built by the mall. Mm-hmm. I would guess this would be more subsidy for that whole part of the corridor through Bloomington, which already is given over $100 million in subsidy from its city taxpayers.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, these ideas that these things are going to pay off later, you know, we're still waiting. We're all holding our breath out in Bloomington. We haven't gotten a dime back yet from any of this stuff. And contrary to the sales pitches that these are all so wonderful, we're all waiting. And all we get is folks coming back and saying, you know, someday we're going to pay all that money we promised, and it's going to be so worth it in your big new tax base. It hasn't happened. But before that, we'd like another subsidy. And this would just be another one. This would be another way for the people of Bloomington and the residents of Hennepin to continue to provide subsidy for these developments around the Airport South District and the Mall of America as it comes through light rail through Bloomington. So, you know, I want to understand how I don't, if I'm wrong on that, I want to know. But I think it's another big property tax increase and subsidy in my city for the developers around the Mall of America. And if I'm misreading it, I want to be corrected.
Mr. Chair, we could specifically exclude Bloomington.
That would help.
Madam Chair, do I take it you're not interested in talking about the Senate's mall provisions today?
We can talk about them, sure. We can vote on them, too. Kill them off so we can stop thinking about them this year.
We'd like you to have additional time to consider the Senate's wisdom on allowing some phased construction at the mall, considering... I mean, the state of the economy, we all know it. I mean, a $2 billion project's not financeable right now, that maybe giving the city the authority to impose some adder taxes and start some phased construction, that we maybe all could benefit from that. Because I believe the current language says there has to be a completed development agreement in place before any of the adder taxes at the mall can be imposed. And I think we need a little flexibility in that so they could start with some kind of phased construction, because... clearly, that the entire project can't happen in this financial market.
Mr. Chair, as the only legislator on the conference committee who represents that city and the only legislator in the state who lives in Bloomington, we have other legislators who represent Bloomington. Senator Dahl, Senator Michelle, Senator Kielash, Representative Slocum, Representative Rosenthal, and me. I'm the only one who lives there. Only legislator who lives in the city. Nobody in the whole city has asked me to give them more tax benefits. No elected officials in the city of Bloomington and no residents. And as I think you know, Senator Bach, the people of Bloomington are not supportive of these proposals. And so I think legislators who want to pursue these should pay for them through their own property taxpayers. And if we would like to pursue this, let's have everybody but the city of Bloomington pay. The people of Bloomington are waiting to receive a tax benefit from this proposal. People of Bloomington have given these proposals over $100 million. They don't pay property tax. We're waiting. Subsidy has gone on and on and on. The people of Bloomington are not interested in a larger subsidy. So if legislators want to pursue this, I think they should tax their own residents to pay for it. It's just getting a little old, honestly. Last year, the proposal received a huge tax benefits that I personally did not support, and yet folks still can't seem to make a development go out there. I mean, that property has more tax benefits probably per square acre than anything on this continent. And why they can't get something built, it's beyond me. Their competitors would like all those benefits. So maybe they need a new developer. I don't understand it. But the people of Bloomington are not interested in subsidizing this project anymore.
I'm sure maybe should tell people what we're thinking here is we're trying to adopt some provisions that aren't too heavy a lifting so that we can get some things over to the governor so that everything doesn't get wrapped up in the end of session. So my hope, Madam Chair, is that by the end of tonight, we can kind of wrap up what might be in a first document that would go to the governor, and then work on these more problematic provisions later this week. So just so everybody understands, but what my thought is and what we've discussed is there's a lot of important work here that for the department and for many of our communities. Many of our members that it would be good to get done and certainly good for our staff to not have to carry an additional couple hundred pages around here in the final final week of the session. So I'd like to be able to get some of this stuff done tonight. We'll have to leave. Some of this stuff's going to have to get left, center, dibble for later this week, apparently.
I could feel Representative Lencheski yielding a little bit.
When you said leave out Bloomington, that helped.
Should we leave out transit TIF too?
Senator
compact
Bach,
development TIF too, or should we try to get any of it done?
Well, Senator Bach, Mr. Chair, I don't think so, but I guess, you know, maybe we should put some creative thought to giving cities some kind of benefit who do not use TIF. And start coming up with incentives for people to stop using TIF. If elected officials locally want to hand out subsidies, they should do it on the transparent property tax instead of hidden in TIF. And maybe we need to. Somebody told me there's one city in the state of Minnesota that has no TIF. Maybe we should. Is it your city? I heard it was a suburb.
Madam Chair, it's a suburb of Duluth. It's the city of Hermantown.
Right.
Who doesn't believe in it?
That's
right.
Got
quite a bit of development going on.
Maybe we should start a new, maybe I should think about this week, something where if you don't use TIF, you get some benefit because TIF is costing all property taxpayers a lot of money. And, you know, I actually carried a bill once to eliminate TIF in the state of Minnesota. I certainly don't support expanding it. And I want to, you know, recognize Representative Senator Rest and Representative Abrams and people who came before me who took an out-of-control local economic development tool and reined it in. And I think it should be reined in further. I think it's unfortunate that this year we have folks trying to sort of take advantage of the fact that we have a recession and say this is a good time to break down all the rules and all the safeguards that people have been put up legislators before me, devised to protect property taxpayers. So people are sort of taking advantage of us and saying let's, you know, throw all the rules out because we're in tough times. And I would caution legislators to think long and hard about going back on things that previous legislators bipartisanly reined in. I mean, we fought off the pre-79 extensions, you and I, Senator Bach, last year, and that was a good thing to fight off that had huge ramifications for years. We have bills now that extend TIF districts 10 years. I mean, why don't we just... I mean, come on. You know, I just think it's people need to think beyond the panic of the moment for what they're thinking about here, because that provision alone in the Metzen bill, we calculated would cost $1 billion to $2 billion in property taxes, that one provision in that bill. And we just all need to, you know, get serious about trying to rein this stuff in and not grow it. So, you know, it's hard for me, honestly, to imagine dealing with this in this small, non-controversial couple hundred pages, Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, could we recognize the good work of the city of Hermantown in this little bill?
Yes.
And give them a little spiff of some kind?
I don't know. What should we do?
They've always felt like the LGA formula doesn't serve them well, and they think they're trying to do the right thing, and they're not using TIF. And I'm very sympathetic with them. They get very little LGA. And I know they'd be – maybe we should reward them.
Maybe we should come up with a formula that you get a bigger bump in LGA if you don't use TIF. Or you get more market value credit if you don't use TIF. This is ridiculous, and we should think about that, because people want to act like it isn't property tax increases. It's absolutely property tax increases.
Either it'd be an LGA offset if you have an excessive amount of TIF.
Yeah. Although it's hard to get the cities that don't get LGA in that. But we have to think about that. Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair. Just
Senator,
frustrating.
Senator Rest, would you like to get in on the TIF discussion at all?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, as you know, we had an approach on the housing districts in our bill. And last week, at one point, Representative Lincheski and I had an exchange about how to approach that. And we drafted some language that was not well received by the House. And so I asked her instead to just to make a statement, maybe three or four different ways of approaching it. And we have that, I think, to hand out. And what I would like, and you and I have talked about this, is just to give it to the House, Representative Lincheski, and maybe later today, if you all are interested in any one of those four, then we maybe could work on something. And if you're not, then I won't have wasted my time.
Madam Chair, so do we have that language?
It's just
there are four different approaches.
Four ideas, okay. And maybe some couple of them you would reject out of hand, but if you're interested, then we can.
Let's, Senator Rest, thank you for your work on that. And why doesn't the House take a look at these four different options? And if there's something there you're interested in talking about this afternoon, maybe we can do that. If not, we can. You can leave that discussion for later in the week.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, we adopted some language on the marinas, 6 acres, and I appreciate the House's willingness to do that. I was thinking about that language as it pertains to the marina where I personally dock at when I go to the Wilderness Golf Course on Vermilion, which is about 11 miles from my house. And that's not on the property tax because it's on the Boys Ford Band's property. But I was thinking about that 500-foot exclusion, just thinking how it applies at that docking place. And I think 500 feet might be too small. I'm just thinking about how that happens there. You come off, but there's a boat launch on one side. It's, you know, they have to be wide enough for at least a couple vehicles to be able to go down at a time. Otherwise, you get big lines of people. And then there's a dock system, because this will be big enough to pump gas. So there's a pretty massive dock system that actually runs along the shoreline. And there's three different fingers then that come out. And there's slips off both sides of all three of the docks. And I can see this thing. I go there quite often. And it just seems like 500 feet. Because, I mean, in these islands that come out, there has to be adequate space for the boats to back out from each island and not hit each other. So it takes quite a bit of shoreline. I'm thinking that 500 feet, by the time you incorporate all those things, just doesn't mechanically seem big enough. And that isn't a big marina compared to many, I'm sure, but that one's not on the property tax. But Representative Marquardt, I'm thinking that 1,000 feet might be a better number so that we kind of get the purpose that we're trying to get at. Representative Marquardt, what would you think of that? And I realize that's making a pretty big leap from the 500 we talked about to 1,000, but.
Mr. Chair, you know, I know your initial bill didn't have any restriction in it. And, you know, I that was a concern of mine was the front footage, because you could have some of these and they could go 2,000, I mean, you know, ever how many thousands of feet, and that was a real big concern. And I don't know for sure how many feet are needed, but I don't know what Madam Chair here thinks, but I mean, would 700 or 800 work? If we were to split that. I'm
thinking about the one that I.
Just
trying to visualize what 800 feet would be. That probably would take care of the one I use, I guess. But I just want to be clear. This isn't for the one that I use,
yeah,
because it's on the reservation, but it's the one I understand when I kind of look at it from the shoreline.
I mean,
could we do 800?
Well, I mean, you didn't have any initially. 1,000 feet seems like an awful lot. 1,000 feet seems like an awful lot. And I guess if you could settle for 800, I don't
just
know what the Madam Chair
would
be. I'll represent Mark. How about 800? Can we do 800?
Mr. Chair, that'd be fine.
800, Council? Oh, no Council. Okay, thank you. Representative Marquardt, I appreciate that. And we'd already adopted that language. So if we can do the 6 acres and 800 feet, I think I guess if it doesn't work, I'll probably hear from somebody next year. But
Sir Chair.
Representative Chesky.
Can the House conferees come up there sometime?
Madam Chair, when would you like to come up?
I'm ready.
Madam Chair, there is a Thursday, August 6th.
Fundraiser for you.
There's a very nice event there at the golf course, and very nice to see them.
No, we're
all
not.
That dockage all full of people, and
we don't
think
want to pay to come.
I think there's about 100 rooms blocked off for people who might want to come. And
the House conferees don't want to pay to come.
I'm sure we could probably figure something out. They could get a free fish fry out of the deal. pretty sure of that.
How big is your boat that it's in the big shed with the forklift?
No, mine isn't, actually, because I'm one of the lucky people that lives on the lake. But many people, fewer and fewer working class people every year have an opportunity to actually have a place on the lake. And so I appreciate the House's willingness to. Because I think looking down the road, it's going to be fewer and fewer kind of working class people have an opportunity to actually have their own dock on the lake. They're going to depend more and more on these kind of places. So to the extent we. To the extent we try to keep them in place rather than the pressure of development. And, I'm always sensitive. I should have worn my fishing hat down here today, as long as I didn't get a chance to go fishing. But there, when the Congress of Minnesota Resorts was at the Capitol this year, they brought white hats. Did you get one, Representative Marquardt? The white hats with the kind of the fishing lures?
Yeah, I didn't.
Representative Conan, did you get one?
I didn't get one.
No, I didn't.
Is it just those of us that represent Lake Country that got those white hats with some fishing lures on them? I'll have to bring mine down. Senator Dibble, did you get one?
Madam Chair.
And I like to fish.
Senator Squire.
My wife took mine. She liked it so well. So I don't have one anymore either.
But, I mean, we've seen what's happened to the we've seen what's happened to the resorts as the pressure and the value of the land, and when it gets time to turn them over, the land's more valuable than it is as a business. And we're down to from 4,000 down to about 900 resorts. And I don't suppose there's anything we can do about that. We've tried to create some preferential tax treatment for seasonal type resorts, and still every year it seems like we have less. And so I think before this starts to happen to the marinas, I appreciate the House's willingness to try and make sure we can preserve them. Is there that land is under the same kind of pressure for development as the resorts are. So Margaret, I really appreciate your effort on that.
Mr. Chair, do you have to make a motion? Do we need a motion on that?
I think we already adopted the language. I think we're just.
Okay.
I think what we're talking about, make sure is in the bill, is 6 acres and 800 feet.
Whatever he says. you don't want to vote on it.
I don't think we need to have another motion on that. What else? Senator Skoy, can you think of something that the house, that scattered housing number of units, we're holding on that. The House is going to consider some language there. The Towning Corporation, we're still holding on. Use deeds. How about, oh, Representative Loeffler's not here. Representative Loeffler somewhere close? Thinking about the Catholic Elder Care Project, but maybe Representative Loeffler should be here for that.
It's her bill, yes. And she's gone to a funeral, so she'll be back
oh,
later.
But she'll be back
later today. Good.
Good. Is Hani here yet?
We can give it a try.
Should we try, Madam Chair, the cross-compliance issue with the Senate's 50% on rural preserves and see if we could make a trade? So, Conan, what do you think? Give it a try? It's a discussion we have to have eventually. we probably should have it. Maybe we just decide we can't get anything done and we just put the whole thing to bed. But if we could get something in this bill, it might be worth having a discussion about today. Commissioner, maybe before we get to the cross compliance, let's talk about that 50% piece in the that was in the conference committee report. And you know, Commissioner, I was driving home that late that afternoon. That was a provision the House brought to the conference committee, and I was thinking about now how are assessors going to be able to implement this on the ground. And I started to think about, okay, now if you're limited to 50% in the rural preserve and I have more than that, who is going to make the decision about which land is enrolled in rural preserve and which one is going to be appraised at highest and best use? Kind of who's going to get to make that decision? And I can see us setting up a real struggle between the assessor and the property owners on that subject. So I'm just kind of wondering if the department has thought about that, how we can give assessors, if that ends up staying in law, how do we give assessors some guidance on that? Or, I mean, do we eliminate that piece? If the department have some thoughts on that, maybe you or Mr. Hagan can tell us where the department's at on that provision.
Chairman, members of the committee, when you were having the conversation with yourself about that provision, we were having it among ourselves at the department. And I kind of apologize a little for not being assertive in the conference committee for flagging it, because it initially thought it would be problematic to administer both from our department perspective and also the assessor's perspective. And I think Senator Skoy flagged some of the concerns on Saturday. Is it the most valuable land? Does the land have to be contiguous? You know, would it provide an incentive potentially for them to cut some trees down in order to maximize their 50% ag? So there's all those kind of issues that I think we didn't have time to really thoroughly sift through during the conference committee, and kind of apologize we weren't more assertive about flagging some of the administrative issues with that provision. So our preference as a department would be to eliminate that provision. We think it's problematic to administer. We think it probably cuts maybe against the purpose of the program. It provides some maybe perverse incentives as far as, the property. And just difficult to know how the land would be valued and how it would be administered. So we've had the same discussions internally, and I think the best course of action is to repeal that provision.
Thank you, Commissioner. Madam Chair, it was the oddest vote. I mean, I remember the vote Senator Vandeveer and Senator Dibble were on the same side. But for 180-degree different reasons. So, I mean, that kind of indicated to me as I was driving home, that's what kind of made me think, what was it about that language that two people that have totally different perspective on this both agree? Had you thought about that? and the Senate hadn't considered that language because it was a House provision. We hadn't had any discussion about it, but... Well, the stranger bolts I've seen, I think.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Marquardt?
Yeah, I mean, I do think it was part of the compromise when we were dealing with the conformity stuff. You know, it came in. It was part of the Ag Committee's bill, Representative Faust, that left that committee. And one of the things I don't, and I understand the reason for it. It was to somewhat put a limit on the amount that could go into that Class B or into the new conservation district and so forth. But I think some of the things that we hadn't thought about before were some of these things brought up. I mean, you've got, might have high value in one area and low value on the other. So where does that 50% go to? The higher, the low value. But I do think we have some things on our side here that would also lead to making sure Green Acres does what it's supposed to do and put some restrictions. That's across compliance. And so while we might be giving up some restrictions on the 50%, if you the cross compliance, I think, would put a little of that in there. So it might be a little bit of a balancing act there.
You know, so Margaret, I was thinking about growing up. One of my dad's brothers had a little rural house on the Rice River outside of Cook. And they were from Chicago, and they would come up in the summertime for a few weeks, and one of my cousins was the same age as myself, and through marriage, his mother's brother, anyway, relative, they'd always come up in the summer so that my cousins could help their uncle bale hay. And invariably, somehow, I'd end up going over there to visit at the time they were baling hay. And so I'd end up, you know, as a young kid throwing hay bales. Senator Scott, I bet you didn't know I had experience at that, did you?
No, I didn't, Mr. Chair.
I've actually piled bales on a hay wagon.
Mr. Chairman, that does develop characters.
I've done that, too.
Senator Dibble's done that. Good. Anyway, the reason I bring that up is I'm familiar with that farm because I spent some time there as a kid, and the Rice River runs through the entire farm, and they don't farm right onto the water. But as I was thinking about it now, if they have quite a bit of wooded property, if I was that farmer, and I don't believe it's in the family any longer, but I would want to enroll all of that river property in the Rural Preserve Program, both sides of the river, and then take all the back forest land and enroll that as highest and best use. And I just can see the assessor and that farmer having a real struggle determining which land is going to be in a rural preserve. I would want the more valuable land, which is all the river frontage, enrolled. So that's what kind of, as I was driving home, made me think, boy, here's a personal case I know of where the assessor and that property owner are really, really going to have a struggle. Yeah. Is it going? If we could work some out on the cross compliance and the 50%, can we put a package together here?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion so we can move this. I think... We're on the same track, but I would like to move what has kind of been agreed to on a cross compliance, move the cross compliance provisions with, there's an agreement being worked out here that I think everyone will be happy with, and deleting the 50%
Senate
requirement.
Taking the Senate provision.
And taking the Senate provision on the 50%.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lucheski.
Can I just restate? So it's Senate on the 50%. House's initiative on cross compliance with an agreement that's being being worked on, but I think Senator Skoy, Representative Marquardt, and Representative Coonan, we don't have language yet, but just to clarify.
Well, I think we could adopt that, and this afternoon we can take a look at that language and make sure that it kind of meets with everybody's, Representative Coonan, is that okay this afternoon? We'll look at that language and make sure it meets with everybody's intent.
Mr. Chairman, that sounds fine.
I think everybody needs to be comfortable. Mr. Peterson, can we don't want to do anything that the ag people aren't in support of here.
Mr. Chairman, I say the department is nodding in agreement.
Mr. Chair.
I care about Mr. Peterson. The department lives over in that building, a new building we built over here that doesn't have any light switches in it. You know, we built a building with no light switches.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I go by there at 10 o'clock at midnight. It doesn't matter. Every light's on. I mean, I don't get it. You know, we're talking, Senator Dibble, we're talking about energy issues here, and we build buildings with all light switches in them.
I mean, Mr. Chair, they must have mice in the building because I think the switches respond to movement in the rooms.
We already have mice.
So I care what Mr. Peterson thinks. I think he's closer to the farmers than people in that building with the lights on all night. So, Mr. Peterson, I want to make sure that that you guys are okay with the department with what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
All trips are okay, so we'll take it. But Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know this has been hard for the House to come around on this 50%, but I really think that this Rural Preserve Program will work better if we're able to get this accomplished. On the cross-compliance, just kind of putting up some goalposts here so we kind of know where they're going to kick this field goal or football. We're talking about eligibility restrictions for green acres. We're also looking at first offense would be notification. The second offense would be tied to some kind of termination. There's the one issue that I'm a little bit concerned about with regard to the cross-compliance that I need people to be aware of. You know, we struggle with the relationship that our assessors have with our landowners. And we are now going to be asking our assessors to be making a pretty important financial determination for landowners on this cross-compliance. And we want to make sure that we're not making the relationship between landowners and the assessors a lot harder. So when we're thinking about this, if there's some way do this through Department of Ag, which is already working with these chemical violation issues, I think it would be real helpful, and I don't know if there is or not, but I think you should think about
that. Mr. Chair, just so it's clear that on the compliance stuff, if there is a tie on that part, the House has to win because we're giving up on the 50%.
Yep.
So if there's so we need.
So let's adopt this, and then we'll revisit the language this afternoon, but the assumption is the language is worked out. How about that?
Yep.
Whose motion?
Mine.
Representative Marquardt. On the Marquardt motion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Contrary, no. The motion prevails.
Thank you.
Representative Conan, thank you. And, we'll see you a little bit later today.
He's got to go for a vote. He'll be back.
I guess, Madam Chair, I'd like to just very briefly have a discussion about the personal property tax exemption on the gas peaking plants, because I'd like to revisit that this afternoon. But I would like the advocates for these proposals to give some thought to something before we talk about it this afternoon. The question that I want to be able to have answered is if they're going to receive a personal property tax exemption, what kind of a payment in lieu are they willing to consider to the host communities? And apparently, in a lot of the personal property tax exemptions we've granted to these, there are agreements in place for a payment in lieu of taxes to those host communities. And I don't know what percentage of them, but I'm told, you know, in about half of them at least, there is an agreement with the host cities. So, Senator Skoy, I believe you have one. So to Mr. Kramer and his staff, if we could find out what kind of discussion they've had, or if I think the legislature's going to do that. We need some effort, I think, on the part of the owners of these facilities to reimburse those local governments for some of the costs that they incur from having those facilities in their community, especially as it relates to fire departments with a lot of additional equipment and training that they wouldn't have otherwise. So, and then the same thing on Senator Olsen's, Representative Kalin's. And what has the discussion been? Maybe I can put Mr. Cassidy in charge of that. Kind of what's the discussion been relative to an in-lieu payment there? Because these are, and then, Madam Chair, I do have some language that I asked Council to put together that I'd like to talk about kind of as part of the package, that revenue actually find out for us. Commissioner, I think we've got 40-some of these in law. How many actually ever were built? Because I believe probably only about half of them have ever been built. And of the ones that have been built, kind of what does the property tax shifting look like in communities? I mean, how much are we exempting, and what's the impact to other property owners in those communities? I think we need to have some more information on this. So as we consider these, we understand the property tax impacts that are happening in communities that where these kind of facilities receive these exemptions. So, Commissioner, if you could think about that, I've got Council working on some language asking the department to bring us a study of, you know, how many of these exemptions they are, what is the property tax impacts in those host communities, the shifting that goes on. So I think we have a little more information going forward, because I'm troubled by people coming with proposals and saying, well, you've done this 21 times, you've done this 22 times, so now it's time to do ours. It just seems like we're making these decisions without not enough thought. So if the advocates for the two that are in front of us can give that some consideration between now and later this afternoon, I'd like to know more about what the discussions have been with the host communities.
Mr. Chair, what about the
pollution control? Representative Seifert.
Mr. Chair, on the housing districts, if either staff or the authors or advocates could answer some questions, I'll just kind of get them out there, and people are in the room, but the properties acquired by the cities, are they going to be purchased from the owner using eminent domain or some other combination would be one question. And then when the properties are the properties going to be sold once they're repaired or rebuilt, and then how are they going to be sold? Are they going to be real estate agents, nonprofit groups? Is the city going to start turning into the realtor office, or how does that work? And I just thought food for thought for those who are advocating when we get back. And I have to run to Rules Committee in a few minutes, and I know Representative Loeffler is on there too, so I apologize if I'm leaving about 15 minutes.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Seifert. So if the advocates of the two plants could think about that, all those issues also relative to the land that they're going to go on, I think that would be good information for the committee to have. Madam Chair?
Mr. Chair? Is Representative Marquardt going to tell us the six presidents that are counties? I think I've got five.
I just handed it down.
Very good.
I'm going to write them down.
I'm guessing on the six.
Let me get a pen. I want to write them down.
Mr. Chair, I did get a winning ticket already from Representative Seifert, so he does win the prize.
Whatever. Does he teach history too?
He is.
Many years
I think
ago.
Yes, okay.
Here they are. Washington County. Jackson County.
Got it.
Grant County, yep. Lincoln County, and then the other two would probably be the last ones you'd maybe get. Polk County.
Think in it.
And then Fillmore. After our 13th president.
You got it.
Millard Fillmore. So there they are.
That is
okay,
a great,
I failed.
That is a great trivia question.
That is. Fillmore County. I wouldn't have thought of that. Polk and Fillmore.
I'm not sure how many of the 87 counties I actually could name.
Better bone up on that, Mr. Chair. I'll help you.
I need the 87. I need 80 of them.
I'll help you out.
Okay, great. Senator Squire?
Interesting.
Are we going on to other issues, or are we talking about
county? Let's talk about something else.
County program aid?
Well, Mr. Chair, while we're doing the personal property tax exemptions for utilities, this
exemption. Should we have a little discussion with the House about the Senate provision that we have that deals with the pollution control exemption, and the thought that what's going on in Minnesota is that, you know, currently what happens is the utility makes the request to the Department of Revenue for the exemption, and of course they want to get a sales tax exemption on their equipment that they buy for pollution control. Originally this was limited just to stack scrubbers, but it's been expanded quite a bit over the years. And if people can't hear me, I'll talk into the mic. So, you know, this has been going on now, and they make this application to the department. The department doesn't have the technical knowledge to know what is pollution control equipment, so they send it over to MPCA for their determination as to whether it's personal or pollution control equipment or not. Then they send it back, and they grant the exemption. But, you know, there's really nobody in there that's questioning whether this truly is necessary for pollution control or not. And so the Senate provision actually brought the local jurisdictions into this discussion a little bit, and you know, maybe they're not appropriate to whether they should have approval or not, but I really think that this is a pretty important issue, and that we should you know, take a little look at it, because somebody needs to take a look at what's going on. Senator Murphy, this is a Senator Murphy provision, and from the discussions that we've had with him and the testimony we had in committee, you know, a lot of this stuff that's receiving this exemption, it's parking lots and electrical panels and stuff really that's not tied to the pollution control for the utility. And, of course, the utility wants it to be exempt, and, the department, they don't really care, and MPCA, they would like as much of this stuff out there as they can get, so they probably don't have any incentive to review it real hard. I was wondering if we could have the Department of Revenue give us some help, and we do have some language that we've drafted up with that in regard.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Scoy, you know, a couple of things just thinking about this is, one is Representative Wagenius, and is it Senator Anderson? I mean, this is a environment issue as well. So at least on our side, we want to talk to Representative Wagenius. But, you know, I did talk to some of the advocates of this, and, you know, my feeling was they might have a point there, but I sure wouldn't give that sales tax exemption to a city. It's a state sales tax, and if it's going to go away, it should come back to the state. So,
no, I think we're talking about a property tax exemption.
Oh, the property tax. Okay, because there's a sales tax exemption with that pollution control equipment as well.
Yeah.
And when I talked to some folks, they were talking about the sales tax. I guess they mentioned the property, too. I mean, the state sales tax is the state's, so I wouldn't be interested in that at all. The property tax exemption, I guess, just thinking about it, maybe it's a sense of, you know, justice to the host communities, but then they would have a larger tax base and therefore less LGA, so I don't know that they net gain anything. But
well, Madam Chair, if they're an LGA city.
I think the cities who brought it to me are LGA cities.
Because, I mean, I think in one that I'm aware
there's
of.
There's one that is not, and all the rest are.
I know you know, up in Cohasset,
yeah, that's
gets little or no LGA up in Senator Saxon's district.
Right. I think the others all would just lose.
I
mean,
Becker can't be an LGA city.
I guess I was thinking Red Wing and others.
So, I mean,
you know, they would just lose
couple,
LGA, so I don't.
There's at least a couple of those host communities that don't receive LGA.
Sure, I mean, we're interested, you know, we'd be open, but I, you know, Representative Wagenius, I know, has, you know, this was an environmental initiative is where it comes from.
And Madam Chair, I think to Senator Scoy's point, we're not at all trying to say you shouldn't have the exemption on equipment that's related to improving the environment, but we need to make sure it's limited to that so that we're not exempting equipment that there's just apparently no review process right now where we can be certain that we're not exempting things that really weren't intended. So I think Senator Scoy's got on the right track that we require PCA and revenue to collaborate on this to make sure that the exemption really meets with, I think, what the legislative intent is, and it's not something beyond that. So I think we'd like to talk about kind of in the discussion about the whole exemption on the gas peakers. I think we'd like to have that discussion also.
Okay.
We do think that the House provision of just doing a blanket exemption going forward for these kind of plants is problematic. I mean, how do we ever give any leverage to host communities to leverage any kind of an in-lieu payment? Because some are being made today. If we just do a blanket exemption, it seems like we disadvantage the host communities pretty badly. So I think it's an important discussion to have. I mean, we're going to be building more of these as more wind gets built, and we all know that wind needs a backup, and it. Today, at least, people seem to argue that it needs to be gas.
Senator Bach.
Representative Lencheski.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And, you know, I hear you there. I mean, we were trying, in my time on taxes, it's just they come forward and everyone just does them. So I think this is Representative Garofalo's provision to just say, hey, since you approve them anyhow, just do them. But I understand your point. I think the one that's of immediate concern that we do need to figure out is Representative Kalin's. I don't know who the senator is.
An Olsen.
I mean, we'd like to get that resolved. And I don't know if that's a, you know, in the current bill here or, you know, how we do this, but.
I believe
they're kind of all to, you know, you've got a myriad of issues here.
Yeah, I'm interested in knowing what the in-lieu of payment discussion is relative to that plan. And I know I understand there is one going on.
Right.
I don't know if it's totally resolved, but I think it would be good for us to know that. Because I think it's an important discussion going forward on these that I think the argument needs to be more than, well, you did the last 21, so now do ours.
Right.
Let's find out what the relationship between the host community and this new property that's going to be tax-exempt is. So we'd like to talk about that this afternoon. Senator Scott, anything else we...
Well, Mr. Chair, to Representative Blancheski's point. Is this something, if we can get these language hammered out today, that would be appropriate for this bill?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Chesky.
Mr. Chair, I think the immediate one that I think would be nice to fix is the city that, or the area that's got one going on right now is the Kalin bill. You know, so I don't know on the rest.
Senator Scott.
Well, Madam Chair, I mean, there is the one going on up by Bemidji also. It's a smaller issue. But, you know, I mean, it's in my district. And to just be real straight, they come and they talk about, well, we're going to build this out in central North Dakota if you don't get this personal property tax exemption. Well, I mean, you know, they're right on a gas line. They're right by a facility. They've already got another unit there. I think that Senator Bach is right. We need to push the host community issue a lot more. But the other thing is, you know, with these exemptions, we need to be looking at all of them, and the pollution control is another one that needs to be looked at. And I don't think it's an environmental issue because, you know, they're going to do the pollution control. That's all mandated at the federal government level. It's just whether we give them a personal property tax exemption for it or not.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lencheski.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Scott, I guess I think, and Representative Seifert has just handed me this, you know, the Representative Kalin issue is also a Representative Eastland issue on our side. I think they have a little bit of a disagreement, but I think their community would like that one resolved. I think the property tax exemption issue and the broader, should we just blanketly approve all of these as they come along, I think we're going to need to get Commissioner Ines's thoughts on, or maybe Ms. Cadoon can tell us where the department is on those kind of proposals, depending where we want to place it.
So. I think, Madam Chair, what the Senate was thinking about is that we have the department study this issue and come back with more information for us. I mean, how many have some kind of a in-lieu of payment with host communities? We don't have a clue on that. I think we need to know that going forward. So I think there's information that we all could benefit from. We'll have staff this afternoon work on some language relative to some department getting us some more information.
Well, Mr. Chair, is the department already working on this? I mean, the House has been told nothing about any of this.
This is just my idea, Madam Chair. Senator Scoy and I have talked about it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have taken a look at which ones have been built and gotten market value where we could, so that we could do the revenue estimate on the proposal. But I do not know if we have any information on in lieu of payments. We'll have to check with the experts on that.
Somebody behind you is nodding their head no.
Okay.
You do not have information on that. Okay, so I think that would be important information for us to have. So that next year when somebody comes with one, we kind of set the bar a little bit for them as far as a relationship with the host community. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the House kind of blanket proposal, as you termed it, it does require that the local unit of government sign off on it. So it doesn't take the whole city or county out of it. I mean, you still have that part, so they could still work out some sort of an agreement. And I have to say I'm getting information. Jackson County was named after Henry Jackson, a member of the first Minnesota Territorial Legislature. So I should have said six counties named the same as presidents, but there might be a seventh, because Houston County was named after Sam Houston, president of the Republic of Texas. So I'm getting this information or is moving here as we go.
We should. This should be required viewing for sixth graders across the state.
Yeah, I'm learning all the time. This is some good information.
Very valuable.
Yes.
To our deliberations here. Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One other thing to raise that maybe we can talk to today, and maybe it doesn't belong today, but I was told when I came in the room that there's been some discussion with the cities and counties about the whole OPEB. You know, we're trying to repeal it. We heard you. The Senate is not. I think the governor would be with us, would be my guess. I don't know if Commissioner Ines can tell us that later. But my understanding is there's some effort being made by some folks with the counties and the cities to look at some maybe moderate language change that's, I guess, more aligned with the Senate, but at least has something for the House. And I don't know what it is. I was just told that, so maybe if it works today, there's time for that, and maybe not.
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Carlson, if we have something that could somehow fit into this bill that we can kind of get off the table here today, but, I mean, I'll say it again. I would like to kind of wrap up the small stuff here tonight, mm-hmm. and so to the extent we can get some things done and out of the way, there'll probably be less people in the room the rest of the week. And some people can get some rest and not have to sit around here all day, all night. I understand Health and Human Services went pretty late on Saturday night.
They're done.
They got done, I believe, right?
Mm-hmm.
I did notice an email came across last night. My phone, my handy new high-tech phone here that I don't understand how it works, came across with an email last night, the Public Safety Conference Committee report. It was about 10 o'clock, came across on my email that it was... Revisor had posted it online, so public safety bill also apparently is done and ready to be voted on. So we may have quite a bit of floor action. So we will try, Madam Chair, to recess.
Mention it.
Representative Margaret?
Mr. Chair, there's something I think we could do in a minute here, if that would be all right.
We've got about
Senator Scoy and I talked about that.
We've got about six or seven.
It's these real minor mandate relief provisions in... House Article 4, it's page 31 or 32, depending on where you're at or which sheet you have. But it would be Article 4, Sections 9, 10, 11, and 15. 9 and 11 deal with cemeteries. 10 deals with compensation of fence viewers, which were almost all similar. And then 15 is a new one. That would strike the $10 cap on booking fees and allow a county to recover actual costs of booking. I think those would be.
Representative Marquardt, you know, I've...
Mr. Chairman.
I've thrown... Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, those provisions were part of the article, local government, that was in Senator Berglund's mandate relief bill. And now I think the leadership has decided that those mandate bills are going to be moving separately. And those provisions are in the local government one that's coming out of rules today, and if they're not all there, I would, and it's my bill, I'd be happy to include them there if you rather have it done there rather than in the tax
Senator
bill.
So, you've heard these in your committee?
The provisions that are in Senate file, whatever it is, yeah. And so it's going to be moving separately, and they certainly would be appropriate if there are some extra ones to put on that bill. Representative Markwood, if you'd like me to do that.
So, Representative Markwood, could you please, you know, you heard me say that I've thrown hay bales onto a wagon, but I don't know what a fence viewer is. So somebody has to help me.
Mr. Chair, I think it had to do with cartways, and they'd come out, and I don't know specifically, but maybe so, I don't know. Maybe they can help on that.
Let's adopt it, but would somebody please come tell me what a fence viewer is when I get outside the room here so I know what I just adopted?
I think it's very minor.
Apparently we agree on it because it's in both bills, but we didn't hear it in taxes. So, Ms. Dalton, what's a fence viewer? Then we call them a viewer.
But that was shotguns for that.
Sir Squire? You know, Mr. Chair, these fence line issues and these land disputes, they were, you know, in the past fairly easy or more easily resolved because you had the traditional corner post or whatever. But with the advent of GPS, so people get their coordinates and type in their coordinate on the GPS and they go out to where the corner is supposed to be and it's not there, and then they want to move the line because the GPS point says it should be over there. I think at some point the legislature is going to have to deal with this issue, and I know the DNR has done a bunch of work up in northern Minnesota where they have gone out and done GPS points, and they want to take, you know, some 150 feet off this field or move these lines around so they are in accordance with the GPS points and not the traditional survey markers. It's getting quite controversial, some of this stuff.
You know, Madam Chair, in addition to throwing hay bales, I spent one summer working for St. Louis County out actually looking for old monument, corner monuments, looking for the original scribings, looking through the old logs, actually chaining out through the forest, and it was very, very interesting to look at the old logs from, you know, the late 1800s when the land was originally laid out. And as I understand it, when you find one of those old monuments and locate that corner, that is the corner of your land, not what the GPS says. The old monument is where the line is. And there is going to be more disputes relative to that going forward, because people can find where they think their corner should be with a GPS, and it might mathematically supposed to be there, but it's not really there. If there is an old historical monument that you're able to identify, that prevails. Did you know that, Madam Chair?
Are the historical monuments movable?
Hmm? Well, they're not supposed to be. They're cement.
I mean, how big are they?
Madam Chair, they are... when they originally went through and surveyed the countryside, they started at the baseline, I believe, Representative Markwart, in Kansas, and moved forward with a compass and a chain and laid out by township. And what they did to mark where the corners, where the corners were, is they would, in the forested land at least, they'd put a blaze on a tree and create a scribe. And the old original ones I saw that were 100 years old were like an S. And they would scribe a tree, and then they'd scribe another tree, and then they'd give compass directions and how many feet it was. And oftentimes it was 5 feet, it might be 40 feet. And they'd have two or three, they're called bearing trees, that would give you the direction and the footage to where the corner really is of the property. And it was... incredibly interesting to learn about.
is interesting.
I spent a summer doing that. It was, I actually had an uncle, one of my dad's brothers, did it for years for the county, was a surveyor that went out and located old bearing trees and established original corners. And there's a lot of that work been done in St. Louis County and in other counties, I'm sure. But it's pretty interesting. And those old bearing trees, if you can find one, they prevail over the GPS.
And Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, you know, in a previous life, you know, I logged. And one of the things that we always looked for was those, because it's against the law to cut them down. I mean, they're, you know, permanent records. And one time we were out in the middle of the swamp south of Big Falls. I mean, goodness knows where we were, you know, logging. And there was one of those trees. It was the darndest thing. And so we, you know, we worked around it and called the DNR, and they came, and then they put a, you know, a permanent metal tag on it and all of that stuff. But it's pretty cool. Somebody was out 100 years earlier, you know, blazing trees. And there it was.
It's amazing.
And Madam Chair, it's just amazing because most of them that I was able to find were actually, you know, you'd go through the old surveyor's originally log and the log, and they'd talk about going through so many chains of a certain kind of topography, and they went by maybe a big rock and then identified in their log, and it was quite incredible. And then when they indicated where the corner was and they established the bearing trees, they would tell you in 1881 or 1883, whatever year it was, how many inches in diameter the tree was, and that they had scribed what species the tree was. So then your job when you would find one of them was to try and resurrect 100 years later what species the tree was. It's, you know, and forest fires went through much of the area, and oftentimes it would be a small little slab of wood laying on the ground left of what the tree was, and as you kind of dusted it off, you might find that little S scribe on there. Then you'd have to determine from that point, well, now where's the other bearing tree? So it's kind of a mathematical equation because there was always more than one to establish where the corner was. And it was pretty interesting work. So I understand the issue of, well, now that I understand what fence viewers are, I understand the disputes. Now that people have their new GPS technology, they might think that this is right, but it isn't. And I found old tobacco tins around those places, and little old, apparently they had a little bottle. They drink a little bit, too, those guys.
So surprising. Oh,
it really was incredible work how close they were, considering it was done by hand. They didn't have anything that even resembles the kind of compasses we have today. It's pretty incredible work that was done. No roads. I mean, they for townships and townships and, you know, hundreds of miles and no roads.
You know, Mr. Chair, you know, the other thing, speaking of compasses, I don't know how many people have ever used a compass very much, but, you know, it's north, you know, east, south, west. But the cruiser's compass is north, west, south, east, because they're always looking at it through a mirror.
Huh?
Yeah,
is
sure.
They're backwards.
Well, this is what surveyors are called, cruisers.
Cruisers, okay.
Why do they look back?
Well, because they hold the compass up to get the north, then they've got a mirror and a line for suiting their next point that they're going to get, so they're always looking at the compass in a mirror. I should bring one. I've got my dad's old cruiser compass. I'll bring it and show you.
Madam Chair, my dad also gave me his, and it's a very treasured piece of family property, because I remember as a kid at our hunting camp, my dad had more fun with that compass around the dining room table, because when you set it on the table and look at it, west is east and east is west. And we had more fun at happy hour with that compass, arguing about which way was east and which way was west, that my dad spent decades having fun with people about the fact that you had to look in a mirror to really make the compass work.
That was done at the cabin at the deer camp, remember?
Ah, oh yeah, lease lands.
Oh, that issue's outstanding yet.
Oh, no. Yeah, that's, no. Lease lands, we can't, no.
Madam Chair, can I briefly mention that this
afternoon?
I've
just already regretted last year.
Madam Chair, I'd like to, I have to get that on the We have to get that on the agenda because I want to just briefly recognize that, understanding that there might be something the House tonight might not want to get to until the second bill, but I want to just briefly mention something relative to that this afternoon. Representative Marker, what's your motion on fence viewers and others? Let's get it done.
Mr. Chairman, it is in my bill.
It's in her.
It's coming out of the Rules Committee today on the local mandates, all of those provisions.
So I don't think we need it.
In the House?
You don't need to do it.
You
can just ignore them here, and we can just put it with the mandates.
Okay, well, as long as it's getting done, it will be less weight for us to carry in this bill. We don't want to put anything in here that might cause a veto, and you never know. Madam Chair, let's recess to the call of the chair. Let's see, you know, I hate to do 5 minutes if they're having a hard time getting set up on the floor up there. So let's recess to the call of the chair, thinking that we'll be back by 11:30 or so.
Okay.
Just want to make sure the bodies actually get in, and the intent would be to meet while you're caucusing and see if we can get a few more things done here.
That's good.
Okay, and then if somebody sitting out there has something small, it's non-controversial, that we have forgotten, if you might want to bring it up to Mr. Rundquist, we'd like to get some of this little stuff that people think is not controversial in this first document that we're going to try and move here. So, Representative Conan, you're just in time. This committee is in recess.